Thank you for joining us on this Ethics and Conflict of Interest podcast. I'm Kathleen Akin, an assistant professor of medicine in pulmonary critical care and sleep medicine at Yale and the director of the medical intensive care unit at VA Connecticut. And I have the pleasure of interviewing today Dr. Lenny Sicilian, the clinical director of the Adult Cystic Fibrosis Program at Mass General Hospital. He's also the co-chair of the ATS Ethics and Conflict of Interest Committee with me, and will be helping us think about how best to recognize potential conflicts of interest in our professional obligations and to consider strategies for managing conflicts of interest, as well as thinking about what would be some obvious red flags for unmanageable or disqualifying conflicts of interest. So Dr. Sicilian, thank you so much for participating in this podcast with us.
You're very welcome, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
So I think it would be helpful just for our membership to start to consider what we mean when we're talking about conflicts of interest. And I was wondering if you could potentially help walk us through some of the aspects of conflict of interest that present themselves for ATS members in their academic pathways, and what are some of the more common pitfalls that you've noticed along the way?
Sure. Conflict of interest has gotten somewhat of a bad rap over the years, mainly because it tends to mean different things to different people. And I'm sure all our listeners out there will realize if they have to disclose to the ATS or their own institution or when they give a speech that sometimes the rules are different. And one of the problems is there is no consistent or set of rules across the country for disclosing conflicts. I think the other important thing to remember is that conflict of interest arises out of the fact that we all in our day-to-day life have competing interests. And these competing interests, you know, can be as simple or complex, if you want to view it that way, or as do I need to cut this last patient I'm seeing in clinic short so I can pick up my child from daycare so I don't get fined? Those are competing interests. A competing interest becomes a conflict when your decision becomes really about yourself benefiting as opposed to the person you're supposed to be either helping as a patient or in the educational setting, which is really the main focus of the ATS, if the information you're transmitting isn't the best information, and by transmitting that information, you are actually causing yourself to benefit, either benefit by receiving money, say, from a pharmaceutical company that might be paying you to be on a speaker's bureau, or giving information that might maybe make your next grant proposal look better than it really is. So we all have competing interests. They become conflicts of interest when you put yourself or the person declaring those competing interests now makes their role more important than the role they're going to do, teaching, clinical care, etc. The other important thing I think we need to remember, and some people lose track of, is that having these conflicts, having these competing interests, and even if they are actual conflicting and can't be managed, it's not a value judgment. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person or not a good teacher or not a good clinician. So I think we need to keep that clear. Conflict of interest isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it represents a risk that you might not transmit best information or might not provide the best care. And you're putting yourself, the person who's in that position, is putting themselves in ahead of their task, so to speak.
Thank you for helping us think about these conflicts of interest. It's also, I think, very helpful to remind us that it's not a value judgment, but really in the interest of us being as honest as we can about where we might have these potential competing interests becoming conflicts. Is that along the lines of what we're getting at?
Yes, I think that's it. And the in relation to the ATS, I think we have to remember that the ATS has a certain reputation and standing nationally and internationally. What the ATS says and does influences policy. It influences patient care, say, in relation to their guidelines and their lobbying efforts, so that when one of our members is presenting data or representing the ATS, it's really important that that there is no conflict of interest, that that member is not really doing something that represents themselves, but or tends to or may benefit themselves, but is something that is the best available information for the good of either education or patient care.
So as we think about ATS in general, I was wondering if you could help us understand the process that's used by ATS in order to identify and manage conflicts of interest.
Okay. Well, the process that's used was described in the ATS policy that was approved by the board in 2008, calling the Policy on Management of Conflict of Interest in Official ATS Documents, Projects, and Conferences. It actually outlines the basis for why it's important to disclose your competing interests and to resolve them if they are conflictual, if they do rise to the level of a conflict of interest. And that holds mostly, it holds really for all ATS activities. So if you are connected with the ATS and you are going to work on a guideline or present a paper or participate in a conference or be on a committee or run for ATS office, you have to declare your interests. So that's called disclosure. And all people in the ATS who are either part of the administration, and this includes ATS staff, leadership, people who are session chairs at the international conference, presenters, and people who work on guidelines, both chairs and members of the panel, have to disclose their competing interests. Once that disclosure is made, usually if it is an educational thing like a conference or the international conference or a guideline committee, the chair of that session has to review your disclosures and determine based on what you disclosed whether there is any conflict or potential conflict, that this competing interest may supersede the interest of the ATS in general. And if that's the case, there are several ways in which you can try to mitigate that. And I can go into those if you'd like me to.
I think that would be really helpful to hear what we could do to mitigate potential
competing
interests.
Right. I think the most important thing is that people should feel free to disclose. And that's why I mentioned that this is not a value judgment. If you have a relation with industry or own some private entity, if you're a clinician or if you have intellectual property, it's appropriate to disclose that because, in fact, the ATS encourages these things as a development of new knowledge. It's only when that knowledge is used for your individual benefit greater than the benefit of the ATS or the patient you're taking care of, et cetera, that it becomes a problem. We at the ATS, ever since we've started with our work on the Ethics and Conflict of Interest Committee, we've really operated under the principle that we believe that the vast, vast majority of ATS members, even those who have competing and conflicting interests, are really doing things out of the best interest and not themselves. And that's been proven out by cases over the years. There are very few instances where there's really been a purposeful avoidance of disclosing conflicts and dealing with them appropriately. So we assume when most of the people disclose that they're doing this honestly and they're really hiding nothing. And I think that's reflected in the submission, say, for the international conference, because when those are reviewed by session chairs, it's found that the vast majority, greater than 85% of presenters, don't have any competing interests that would conflict. In the situations where your interest may represent a conflict, may represent that risk, the chairs of the session or the chairs of the guideline committee will review your data, and they may ask you to submit what you're going to say so they can review it to make sure that there's no obvious situations where you would be putting your interests ahead of the interest of whatever group you're working for. Most of the time, conflicts are dealt with in that way. Sometimes there is an interest, say a relationship with industry that is a conflict of interest. Not all of them are, but if it is, you may be asked, say, as part of your presentation, to avoid making recommendations regarding the product that you're affiliated with and that may benefit both you and a third-party industry partner that you're working with. And those are how most of them are revealed, so that hopefully by the time a guideline comes to fruition or you hear a presentation at the ATS, the majority of conflicts have sort of been removed. And that's important for the ATS because in order to grant CME credits, for example, we have to ensure that to the American College of Graduate Medical Education, who sets some of these rules. Now, there are cases where the relevant conflict really can't be decided by the chair or the person who's running the particular event, so to speak. And that is when the ATS, either leadership or members for the Ethics and COI Committee, will get involved to help resolve these things. And I think hopefully in a couple of months what we're going to try to do is to publish either online some examples of cases like this so people can use them as guides. That's a rare occurrence, but occasionally it goes to that level. There are rarely conflicts that cannot be resolved, and then the person has to be asked to not participate in either the guidelines or the presentation, etc. There are several shades of participation, and this occurs especially, say, in guideline documents where the ATS is making recommendations that many, many people listen to. Sometimes people who do have conflicts can take part in the general discussion because a lot of individuals who do have conflicts are really experts in the field. And you don't want to lose that expertise. So they may be involved in the discussions, but they might not, they may be asked to recuse themselves during the rating of the data or making final recommendations, either as a whole or for the part of the recommendations where their conflict lies. So again, the bottom line becomes, if you declare your conflicts, the vast majority of the times they can be resolved, and you as a member of the ATS can get to participate in the activities, and the ATS can maintain its quality.
Thank you for that thorough discussion of how these decisions are first sort of brought to light. I did wonder, because it does depend a bit on an honor system for the participants and presenters to identify these potential conflicts, and it sounds as though erring on full disclosure would be the preferred and recommended way to ever consider addressing potential conflicts of interest. But I'm also thinking about the audience members or the reviewers of guidelines, or I should say consumers of guideline documents, who might themselves feel as though there's something that's being left out that they know about an individual. How might an ATS member bring that up to somebody if they okay. themselves had concerns about potential conflicts of one of the participants.
You're right. I think that, and that does happen. I think the best and most direct way when that happens is to contact either the person who is, say, the chair of the session that you're looking to, or the chair of the guideline committee, or in even if you don't want to go to that level, you can always contact the ATS Ethics and Conflict of Interest Committee. This or any feedback we get or complaints we get are kept strictly confidential. They are explored. We do discuss them with the chairs or guideline chairs, and we will find out from the individual involved what actually happened. Again, as you point out, this is an honor system. Full disclosure of everything would be best. If you look at the international conference, for example, your disclosures, according to the ACCME rules, say you just have to disclose financial relationships relevant to the topic. Obviously, then someone has to decide, is my work with company X relevant to the topic that I'm talking about? Some people say no. Other people may see a conflict there. And I think that has led to problems in the past. That's why I agree with you that people should disclose fully. That gets into a time issue and a lot of other things that we're trying to work on at the ATS Ethics and Conflict of Interest Committee. But there's always an option for someone who is concerned that there was a conflict that benefited the speaker or the writer of the document more than it did the consumers of those events. You can always talk to the ATS and it will be pursued.
That's very reassuring.
I would like to say one thing, too, which always comes up about the conflict of interest portion of the Ethics Committee, is that we're not the police. We don't go around looking for offenders. We will respond to people who have concerns, but we're not trying to turn over every stone to try to find people who are not disclosing. We do have an honor system.
Yes, and I guess the one thing that stands out for me as the absolute unmanageable conflict would just be related to tobacco industry sponsorship.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
That is accurate. Go ahead.
Oh, I just wondered if there were other sort of absolute contraindications or conditions that can't be managed that you could think about.
The tobacco situation can't be managed, and that's an issue of policy based on the behavior of the tobacco industry. People who have an association with the tobacco industry certainly are not allowed to run for ATS office, and they're usually excluded. Now, some people have had relationships in the past. And depending on that relationship, there may be some room. But in general, I think you have to assume that if there is an association with the tobacco industry at any time, it would be very difficult to represent the ATS in any way in an official capacity. I think as far as other absolutes, not really. And I think one of the reasons for that is that when you look at the whole sort of universe of conflict of interest, a lot of what we do in conflict of interest is sort of based on rules. There's not a lot of data that tell you when somebody is conflicted. There are data that tells us that we tend to underestimate our conflicts, but it's hard to tell how often they really affect negatively the information or you're trying to transmit or the education you're trying to provide. And that's why we usually look very carefully at management. If there are a few things that will pretty much exclude you from certain activities, And those are if you are on a speaker's board, if you are on a an advisory board where you're paid directly by industry, either a pharmaceutical company or a device manufacturer, if those payments go to your family, if you profit directly. However, if you're doing research hand-in-hand with a pharmaceutical company and that research funding goes through your institution, that's not considered unmanageable. That can be managed, and you can participate in the ATS to some degree. So a lot of it, other than tobacco, depends on the circumstances, but there are certain things that are more likely to cause an exclusion than not.
And just for rounding out the considerations of tobacco, where has ATS fallen in terms of the e-cigarette and electronic nicotine delivery devices and conflict of interest?
Right. At this point, doing research on or presenting on or participating in anything that has to do with e-cigarette use, the ATS does not consider that at the same level as tobacco at this point. And the main reason for that is that it is still a field undergoing research. As most members know, there's conflicting data regarding whether this is helpful in smoking cessation or whether it addicts more younger children into frank cigarette smoking. The data are still open, and therefore, at least at this time, the ATS has taken the tact of that is a potential conflicting or competing interest, but the ATS in formulating talks, et cetera, and guidelines will consider participation of people who have done research or have spoken on that topic. They would go through the same process of declaration and review that I described before.
I think that touched on the topics I wanted to have us include for the podcast, but I wanted to be sure to ask if there was something that I hadn't started to explore with you that you thought would be important for our members to hear about.
No, I think you've really hit most of the highlights. I think what the ATS Ethics and Conflict of Interest Committee would like to get across is really that this is something important, but it's not it doesn't stifle you and it doesn't prevent you from doing things that you want. It's just a way of ensuring that the ATS is presenting the best information to the public, since it does have a lot of influence. As the committee goes, we would like to study this and do more research on it. I think attendees at the conference sometimes look at the conflict of interest slides that are mandatory, and sometimes they're not up there fast enough for them to even consider what's going on. Sometimes presenters will talk about that. In guidelines, for example, all of those things are outlined in the appendix and declared at the time the guidelines are published. So we'd like to know a little more about how to do this, and we do realize that your institution, your hospital, medical school, et cetera, may have totally different rules for what they think constitutes a conflicting interest. I certainly know my institution does, and what my institution, for example, thinks is not a conflict, I would certainly feel like I had to disclose to the ATS. So I think this is an area in flux. I think the membership needs to know that there are people on the ATS staff and the ATS Conflict of Interest Committee who will help them answer this. I also think it's especially important for, say, trainees, for fellows. Sometimes they are working with individuals where they see a conflict. They don't know how to handle it because they're involved in their training and their mentoring. If they're an ATS member, they can certainly approach the committee and ask for guidance. I certainly wouldn't promise that we have all the answers for everything, but there are enough people involved who would give your question or problem some good thought and maybe help you with some advice.
That sounds like a great message to end on. And again, I encourage ATS members to also, as Dr. Sicilian mentioned, reach out to our Ethics and Conflict of Interest Committee and the existing guideline documents. And I also look forward to some case illustrations that we'll be making available through the Ethics and Conflict of Interest Committee. So this Great. Wraps up this podcast, and thank you very much again for your time. I think this has been a really helpful walk through conflict of interest.
Great. Thank you, Kathleen. Anytime, I'd be happy to do this.